Hare Krishna. It's a very nice theme that has been chosen this year by the Bhaktivedanta Manor, Atithi Devo Bhava. Bhava means to become or to be one. To be whom? Be one to whom Atithi or the guest is Devaha, is like God. So be one to whom a guest is like God. That's what this aphorism means. Does anyone know what the full verse is? Where this line actually comes from? Which verse does it come from? There's a whole verse which is very similar to this one. It starts with Matri Deva Bhava, Devo Bhava, Pitri Devo Bhava, Acharya Devo Bhava, and then Atithi Devo Bhava. So it starts by saying, be one to whom the mother is like God, be one to whom the father is like God, be one to whom the Acharya or the Guru is like God, and be one to whom the guest is like God. This verse appears in one of the principal Upanishads, the Taittiriya Upanishad. It is a section of the Yajurveda, three chapters of the Yajurveda. And it contains many philosophical topics and cultural topics that we are all familiar with to some degree. For example, how many of you have heard of the five koshas? Annamaya kosha, pranamaya kosha, manomaya kosha. You know these five koshas of the soul. Prabhupada speaks about it many times in his teachings. So that is, there's a lot about that in the Taittiriya Upanishad. There's a lot about food in the Taittiriya Upanishad, how we should distribute food. You know, our food for life, ultimately, that principle, of course, we Krishnaize it, and for us it's prasadam, it's not ordinary food. But even the distribution of ordinary food, the virtues of that are extolled in the scriptures. And this scripture, the Taittiriya Upanishad, is one of those. We're doing a seminar called The Culture of Food, so probably we may speak more about that at that session. So this Taittiriya Upanishad contains this very nice proverb. Actually, the Taittiriya Upanishad is named after the sage called Tittiri. In Sanskrit, the word Tittiri refers to a partridge, a bird, the partridge. And it's connected to the pupils of this sage called Tittiri. And therefore, it becomes the Taittiriya Upanishad. And it is essentially a convocation address for graduates of the Gurukul. So when the pupils pass out and they're venturing out into the world, they are given these set of ethical principles or guidelines by which they have to lead their life. Because after all, education is not simply about arithmetic and geography and history. There's a lot about principles and values and character and above all, spirituality and devotion to the Supreme Lord Krishna. So therefore, along with these other philosophical points like the five koshas and cultural principles like food, there's also a lot about the ethical principles that should guide any young graduate from the Gurukul as he steps out into the world. So the Gurukul graduates are told, respect your father and mother, as good as God. Respect your teachers, respect your guru, as good as God. And respect the guest. When you're out there, you'll become a householder. And even if you're not a householder, you're living in an ashram, there are going to be many guests who come. Treat them as good as God. Of course, we should understand the Devo Bhava, Acharya Devo Bhava, or the Matri Deva Bhava, not in an ontological sense or literal sense, it doesn't mean that the guest is actually God. But he is to be treated, or she is to be treated, as good as God. Now, you know, we are living in an age where everybody likes to question before they believe anything. And in a sense, it's a good thing, because we don't want to have blind faith. So many people will tell us so many things. So we should try to be convinced by proper logic about our beliefs. So then, why should we believe in this principle? Atithi devo bhava, matri devo bhava. And what does it really mean? For one thing, imagine if we did not respect our elders, our parents, our teachers, our gurus, and our guests. If we did not respect them, if we did not serve them, what would happen in this world? Can you imagine a social situation where children don't respect their mother, don't respect and serve their father, they don't respect their teachers in school and college, they don't respect their guru, and they don't respect any guest who comes into the house or to the ashram or the temple? What kind of society would it be? Would there be any happiness in such a society? In fact, Vedic culture rests upon the principles of service and respect. You see, without a proper culture, there can be no progress in a civilization. Leave aside spirituality, even ordinary morality and ordinary social cohesion and happiness will not be possible. So one reason why instructions such as these are necessary and important, not just for all graduates of a Gurukul, but for all of us in general, and even as devotees, these principles are important for us, is because they facilitate social cohesion, warm relationships, and general happiness in society. After all, we don't want to be living in a society that is devoid of service and respect, which will only lead to quarrel and hatred, selfishness, ego, and so on. So therefore, this particular verse, all four of these things, Matri Deva Bhava, Pitri Deva Bhava, Acharya Deva Bhava, Atithi Deva Bhava, these four, amongst many other guidelines that are given in the Taittiriya Upanishad as well as in other scriptures, are necessary to maintain this kind of social cohesion and warm relationships. Secondly, you see, mundane morality and social cohesion is not the goal of life. Necessary and important as these ideas may be, the ultimate goal is that we have to become self-realized. We have to advance spiritually in our life. So ethical and moral instructions and a culture of this sort is like a setting in which devotional culture or spiritual culture can actually manifest. You know, you can't have devotional service to the Lord without a culture behind it. If you just say, well, we'll just chant Hare Krishna and you can make your life perfect, and that is absolutely true, but it is true only absolutely, not relatively. On the relative platform, we need a lot of other instructions, we need a lot of other support. When we are sick, we go to a doctor. We don't say, we just chant Hare Krishna and then it'll be all right. So in the relative world, we do need the support of another cultural system. So items like these, instructions and injunctions like these, are very helpful to us. I'll come to another point, which is an important philosophical point, for us to understand why these principles are so necessary for us. And then after talking about this philosophically, then we'll come to the point of some statements from the scripture about the glories of serving guests, because that is our main topic. You see, in this world, our shastras tell us, we are born debtors. We are born in debt. we live in debt and we die in debt. Now, I just don't mean your credit and debit cards and your, you know, bank loans and your mortgages. That is indeed one type of debt, undoubtedly. That's also part of what I'm speaking, but the concept of debtorship is a much broader concept that is given in the Vedic literatures. And essentially, there are five kinds of personalities to whom, or five categories to whom we are indebted in our life. Number one, Deva. Deva means the demigods. Now, the demigods provide us everything that is necessary for us for our sustenance in life. All the natural, the gifts of nature are basically what constitute prosperity, and we depend on these for our survival. We have sunlight, we have the heat of the sun, we have the air, we have wind, we have oxygen, and we have the soil, we have rocks, we need all these things. We need the metals, we need minerals that are there in nature. We need all of these things that are provided by the demigods. And we have to discharge our debt to the demigods. And if we don't discharge our debts, then we have to pay a price for it. Our connection will be cut. Imagine you're getting the benefit of electricity, water, etc. from some company, either the council or some private company. Somebody is supplying you these things and you pay for them. You pay your electricity bill, you pay your water bill, and if you don't pay it, then the company will cut the supply eventually. Similarly, the demigods are supplying all of these things to us. And if we don't respond in gratitude by discharging our debt to them, by paying our fees to them, then there will be some disturbance in these natural supplies. Then there will be famine, there will be floods, there will be earthquakes, there will be other natural catastrophes and disasters. Ishtan bhogan hi vo deva dasyante yagya bhavitah tair dattan apradayaibhyo yo bhungte stena eva sah. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says in the third chapter, in relation to performing sacrifices for the demigods, that it is the demigods who provide humanity with all the necessities of life through natural supplies. And they do so when they are pleased by performance of sacrifices by the human beings. And when a human being avails of these gifts of nature supplied by the demigods, but does not return these gifts to the demigods in the form of sacrifices, then he is called a thief. Yo bhungte. Bhungte means one who enjoys them. Stena eva saha. Stena means a thief. So he's considered a thief. So one is expected to discharge one's debts towards the demigods by performing sacrifices, yagyas. That's part of the karma kanda process. Now I'll come to the devotional perspective shortly. The second category to which we are indebted in life are the rishis, the sages. The sages have actually formed the foundation of our existence in this world. Inasmuch as the demigods provide us the physical infrastructure, so to speak, in which we can survive, the moral, ethical, and spiritual foundation for our survival are the great sages in history. They give us so much knowledge. They have performed so much austerity. And they have learned and they have experienced and realized transcendental knowledge. Scriptures have been revealed to them and they have further revealed this knowledge to humanity at large. And even though the world at large performs so much of sinful activity, in a very large measure, it is because of the austerity and learning and spiritual strength of these sages that the world still sustains. So we have a lot to of gratitude towards these great sages. So therefore, we have to discharge our debt towards them. Just as we discharge our debt towards the demigods by performing sacrifices, we discharge our debt towards the sages by swadhyaya and tapaha. Swadhyaya means study of the scriptures and propagating the knowledge that we have gained in the scriptures to one and all. And austerity, tapaha. Austerity is like, for example, fasting, observing celibacy, and so on. So by doing these things, we discharge our debt to the sages. The third category to which we are indebted according to the Vedic scriptures are bhuta. Now, bhuta doesn't mean ghost. Well, it means ghost, but not in this context. The word bhuta has many meanings. Ghost is only one meaning. But the general meaning of the word bhuta is living entities in general. So we are indebted to all living entities. Humanity is peculiar in that it prides itself on its own capabilities and intelligence. So human beings exhibit enormous arrogance, not just individually, but as a species. And therefore, we as a race are the cause of so much havoc on this beautiful planet, which is not left so beautiful anymore because of human arrogance and greed and the exploitative spirit. Just think of it. The cows provide us milk. The birds provide us soothing music as you wake up in the morning. And we hear these pleasant sounds. We see the beautiful birds everywhere. The trees and plants provide us much needed oxygen, and they take our carbon dioxide in the night. And they provide us shelter and shade, and they provide us so much of beauty and solace. And just a walk in the forest in the countryside when you're down will perk up your spirits like anything. They provide us fruits and flowers and so many other valuables. The microbes in the soil, they're responsible for the growth of plants. The seed can move, fructify eventually into a plant and a tree. So down from the smallest microbe to all the living entities, everyone has a role to play in helping us live in this world. It's a highly interdependent world. So we have a big debt to all the living entities in this world. And we discharge the debt towards these animals and birds and so on, primarily by protecting them. If we simply don't slaughter them, that in and of itself is huge service. And we protect them, but not at home, outside. Meaning you don't keep dogs in your house, and you don't keep all sorts of other living entities in your house. You protect them, but keep them outside the house. So that's the way you discharge your debt towards the bhuta, or the animals, the birds, and the living entities. The fourth category towards whom we have a debt are called nri, or the human race. And of course, we understand very well how dependent we are on human beings. Imagine if we were the only human on earth. Well, it wouldn't be a very pleasant thing. For every little thing, we're dependent on human beings. We need them for company. Otherwise, we'll be bored. We need them even to do devotional service, because without the association of devotees, what can you do? It's very hard. Even in ordinary material life, you can't survive without other human beings helping us. Even as devotees, we're dependent on the material world outside. For example, all of us needed to come to the temple here. So you took a bus, or you took a train, or you took a car, you drove down yourself. So you were dependent on the tube, you were dependent on somebody driving you here, you were dependent on the manufacturers of the automobile in which you sat, on the refineries that produced the petrol that drove you here, millions of things like that. We are dependent for our food on the farmers who supply it to us, on the stores that sell it to us. So we have enormous debt towards human beings. And we discharge these debts primarily by Atithi Seva, by serving guests, and by doing welfare work. Again, this is Karma Kanda. This is the material platform. But we are just building up the point. So stay with me. Finally, Pitri, the fifth category to which we are indebted are our forefathers, our ancestors, for obvious reasons, because if they didn't exist and they didn't procreate, then we wouldn't be here today. So we are grateful to them because they supply us our body. They have supplied us our family. They've given us what's most important to us to survive in this world, which is our body. So we discharge our debt to these Pitris or to these forefathers and ancestors by begetting children and also by performing the Shraddha ceremonies. Then the Pitris are satisfied. Now, we have these five broad categories of debts. And the Vedic scriptures, particularly the Karma Kanda scriptures, they specify a host of duties that a pious human being is meant to perform in order to discharge these debts. After all, any civilized person will want to discharge his or her debt. Even though we are obliged sometimes to borrow things, but a civilized person, a decent person, would not want to default on the debt. A cultured, civilized person would want to always discharge the debt and makes honest endeavor to do so. Therefore, even if we may not be very capable, we've borrowed a large amount from somebody, but at least we make the effort of paying a little something every now and then. We don't just sit back and throw up our hands and say, sorry, I've got money, but I can't give it to you. I don't want to give it to you. A decent person doesn't do that. A pious person doesn't do that. So a pious person in this world is urged by the scriptures, the Vedic scriptures, to strive towards discharging these debts, towards these five categories, by performing the kinds of activities that I just mentioned. Now, we keep on doing this, and we are pious. So we discharge the debt, but there's a problem. And the problem is that these debts continue to accumulate. Why do they accumulate? It's a continuous 24/7 process. Because the moment you discharge one debt or all the five debts to everybody, you know, there are new debts being created. Because you're breathing air, you're still learning, you're still gaining from the demigods and the sages and the people at large. So it's continuously happening. It never stops. So even at the time of death, even though we have constantly struggled and strived to discharge those debts, there's always some debt that remains at the end of the day. Because we've every moment of our life, we keep accumulating those debts. So therefore, we have to be born again in order to discharge those debts. This is called Rinanubandha in Sanskrit. Rina means debt. Anubandha. Bandha means bondage. Anubandha means constant bondage. It's continuous bondage. It's a cycle of bondage that goes on. Because these debts are unceasing. They continue and they go on and on and on. The benefit of doing it, of course, is that leading a pious life, we have a relatively peaceful, sinless life. So therefore, at least we can face the Lord and say, well, I'm trying, I'm doing the authorized thing that is necessary to discharge my debts. But because of this Rinanubandha, we will have to take birth again and again and again. So we are not freed from the cycle of birth and death. We are not freed from suffering really, because birth, death, old age and disease will continue. So even though it's pious, it's noble, but still, because it is on the material platform, it is not really a permanent solution to discharging our debts. We will still remain debtors, and it will be an endless process of just going on discharging these debts. Now, there's three types of life in this world. One is called sinful life. The second is called pious life. And the third is called devotional life. Which are we trying to lead? Devotional life. So sinless life is that in which we pay no heed, no regard to even mobile phones that ring in the class. We don't pay heed to them. We go on with the class. And so in sinful life, we pay no heed to all these injunctions of, you know, what is pious activity, what is sinful activity. We act whimsically in this world, merely impelled by the desire for sense gratification. It's a very materialistic life, a sinful life that leads to enormous suffering. And naturally, it leads to severe bondage in the cycle of birth and death and lower species, birth in the lower species subsequently. So that's something we definitely don't want. Pious life is what I just described. We live a life in accordance with the injunctions of the scriptures, and we try to discharge our debts. We avoid sinful activity as much as possible. But as I mentioned earlier, even pious life is a life of bondage. Then we come to devotional life. In devotional life, we take shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna. And we surrender to Him. And in the very process of surrender and performing devotional service, we become free from all these debts once and for all, permanently. In the 11th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, there is a very important verse. Devarshir bhutaptrinam pitranam na kinkaro nayam brini charajan sarvatmana yaha sharanam sharanyam gato mukundam parihritya kartam. So, this is spoken by the nine Yogendras to Maharaj Nimi. And it says here, sarvatmana gato mukundam parihritya kartam. If there is somebody who approaches Mukunda or Krishna, and in so doing, he or she gives up prescribed duties that are mentioned in the pious section, the Karmakanda section of the Vedas, and sarvatmana, with his whole heart, with his entire being, takes shelter, sharanam, of that personality who is most worthy of taking shelter of. That is sharanyam, that is Krishna. Then what happens? Na kinkaram na ayam rini. That person is no longer a debtor, nor a servant of these five categories. Deva, Rishi, Bhuta, Apta. The word Apta is added here. Apta means relative or friend. In other words, when one surrenders completely to Krishna, then one becomes freed from this debt once and for all. We become permanently debt-free. This is, in fact, the complete solution to all our problems of life. We become free from the rinanubandha. And then, being liberated from the cycle of birth and death, we are eligible to return to Krishna's abode in the spiritual world, the Vaikuntha world. Now, as devotees of Krishna, that's where we are headed. And that's our activity, serving Krishna, being surrendered to Krishna. So now, the question arises, we are practicing devotees, so what does that mean for us with respect to Matri Deva Bhava, Pitri Deva Bhava, Acharya Deva Bhava? How should we as devotees deal with mother, deal with father, deal with teachers, deal with guru, and deal with guests, and deal with human beings and animals and birds? Do we have a responsibility at all? Or is it that because we become devotees now and we've got that certificate stamped from the Srimad Bhagavatam, na kinkaro na ayam rani, we are no longer debted to any of these five categories, therefore Mother, bye-bye to you. Father, bye-bye to you. Guests, nothing to do with you. Animals and birds and humans and teachers and gurus, bye-bye to you. I am a devotee of Krishna. Is that it? No. In fact, we also do these things, but we do it in Krishna consciousness. So therefore, the devotees who have parents should deal with their parents in a Krishna conscious way and serve them nicely. Devotees who are students and pupils in school or university should also deal with their teachers with respect and serve them nicely, even if they are not devotees. Of course, you don't participate in any sinful activity that they might do. Nowadays, a lot of that may happen in college, and the professor may take the students to the pub, let's go to the pub. So naturally, I don't refer to that kind of service. But yes, there must be some kind of respect and service because the professor is giving you some knowledge. The teacher in school is giving you some knowledge of how to read, how to write, arithmetic, and so on. So being devotees of Krishna doesn't mean that we are disrespectful and that we are not grateful. But we understand our limits that are imposed by the philosophy of Krishna consciousness. So we do all these things in Krishna consciousness. And as far as Atithi Devo Bhava, which is the topic, now we come to this topic having given a broad general background. We see that as devotees also we should take care of guests properly. If your household is living at home, you may have people coming home. They may be devotees, they may not be devotees. Of course, as devotees, naturally we serve them well because they are our guests. But even if they are non-devotees, we should still serve them well in ways that I will just describe briefly in a few moments. So the principle of Atithi Seva is one of the cornerstones of Vedic culture. It's considered very glorious to do that. In fact, it's considered an act of great piety. And when we focus that same principle on devotees, then it becomes Krishnaized. It acquires devotional benefit as well. Not just ordinary piety, but it acquires devotional piety. So let's say as a devotee, if you go to somebody's house who's not a devotee, and that person welcomes you well and serves you well at his or her house, then that person acquires that devotional piety which will eventually bring that person to Krishna consciousness one day or the other. And as you may have heard in previous lectures on this topic, the word atithi refers to one who may come to your home unannounced. A tithi. Tithi means the date according to the Vedic calendar, and a means without. Nowadays, of course, you don't dare go to anybody without an appointment. You know, it's got to be set and everything. So, of course, there are practical reasons for that, understandably so. But generally in Vedic culture, you were always open for anyone who came at any time. And you welcome guests into your home, into your ashram, into your temple, wherever you were, whatever place you called your own, you welcomed guests. You never saw the guests as a burden. Even if you were inconvenienced in serving the guests, even if you were doing something else at that time, you dropped everything else and attended to the guest. This is the standard protocol that is given in our scriptures and in Vedic history. It stands out in stark contrast to the beware of dog culture of the modern day. You know what I'm referring to when I say beware of dog culture? You want to go to somebody's house, but there's a big signboard that says beware of dogs. Naturally, you stay away. You're not going to enter into that particular gate because you know that any moment a dog may come and snipe at you or bite your heels or something like that. So we discourage guests. The modern civilization discourages guests. And therefore, modern civilization deprives its constituent members of a valuable opportunity to gain at the very least some piety, if not devotional credit, and eventually devotional service. Because then you don't allow even devotees to come to your house. Srila Prabhupada didn't approve of this visa regime where people have to get visas to go to different countries, especially devotees should be free to go anywhere and everywhere, Prabhupada said. But of course, in the modern day and age, much of this is misused, and we'll be talking about this maybe day after tomorrow. So there are various injunctions in the Vedic scriptures about atithis. I'll just mention a few of them. One injunction that's there in the very Taittiriya Upanishad that I mentioned is that never turn away anyone who comes seeking your hospitality. Very important point. In another scripture it is said, actually in the same scripture, welcome all seekers with the announcement that food is ready, please partake of it. This is guest seva, atithi seva. Srila Prabhupada one time, when he was asked by a devotee, what is the duty of a grihastha? I am a householder, please tell me what is my duty. Prabhupada didn't get into any long-winded description of varnashrama dharma. He just answered very cryptically and briefly. He said, step out of your house before you eat your meals and call out three times. Is anyone hungry? Is anyone hungry? Is anyone hungry? And if there is indeed someone hungry, then you feed that person. And after the person has been fed, then you eat whatever is left. Of course, this is the age of loopholes. So we're always looking for loopholes and we follow technicalities. So we say, all right, Prabhupada asked us to do that, so we'll step out of the house and just whisper. Mutter under our breath, is anyone hungry, anyone hungry, anyone? And we say it so fast, no one will understand. And then we quickly get back into the house and then eat up whatever food we have cooked. And of course, in this day and age, when you're living in multi-storied buildings and so on, you know, how are you going to follow this principle? And also nowadays, it's downright risky to call all and sundry into your house. They could just be burglars or they could do anything. But in any case, we must take the principle of it, the essence of it. You see, many of the things we're going to discuss today, as well as in the next 2 days, and when it comes to serving guests and so on, many of these things will appear to be, and they indeed are, extreme cases. And some of these things will appear to be, and may indeed be also, impractical to do in our situations in life. In some cases, perhaps they're not as impractical as they may seem, but even if they are, the point is we should try to take the essence of it, the spirit of these teachings. Even if we are not so much concerned with the technicality of going out three times and speaking out loudly, is anyone hungry? But the principle that we should be always welcoming guests at home, and we should feed them first and then eat what is left, is a very important principle. I'll tell you one of my favorite stories, which I narrate often. And it's a real story. It's about one of our brahmacharis. Now he's a sannyasi in ISKCON, a dear friend of mine. When he became a brahmachari, he read the Sarva Dharman Parityajya verse of the Bhagavad Gita, and he became really inspired that if I surrender to Krishna, then he'll take care of me. And he was inspired to just go out into the world. You know, he was already living in ISKCON temple, in the ashram, but he wanted to just see how life was if he just depended on Krishna alone, if he surrendered everything to Krishna. So he said, let me travel for a few months without a penny in my pocket. And I want to see, I want to experience how Krishna will maintain me and protect me in all circumstances. So he went And you know, in India, you can still get by without buying a ticket on a train if you're a sadhu. You know, actually, some of our brahmacharis, I remember when I was a temple person in one place, our brahmacharis took it too far, and then I had to go and rescue them from jail one time. Because in the middle of the night, and we were worried sick because these devotees didn't come back, you know, and all night we were wondering where, we were calling here, there, we called police and we went here and there. And finally, in one police station, they said, you know, okay, I think you found your man, he's here. Because they hadn't, you know, bought the ticket for the local trains, just like you have the tube here, you know, they have the local trains. They would distribute books in the train. And when the ticket checker came in, you know, they acted a little smart, you see. They should have been a little humble. They tried to be a little aggressive in preaching philosophy, you know. That's not where you speak much philosophy. At least you should be humble. So the TC, you know, must have had a bad day also. So he arrested them and put them in jail. But anyway, till today, it's still possible to get by. You know, you can go into the third class compartment, keep moving, and, you know, you can do things. So he managed, and he traveled to many places, and the days went by, the weeks went by, and he was surviving. Because there are still people who are pious, they like to feed sadhus. There are temples, there are mutts, there are monasteries where you can go and eat. There are some hotels, even restaurants, where you stand outside and a pious restaurant owner will give you some food free of cost. But he was getting by just with the monasteries and the temples and so on. Finally, he was living in Vrindavan and he headed down, and finally he was traveling way in South India. Now, he didn't know the language also, but he was managing. And then it so happened that then for a whole day he hadn't got anything to eat. And he was beginning to get worried and anxious and hungry like anything. And what's more, in South India they eat only rice. And he, having lived in Vrindavan, liked his rotis and chapatis. And here in South India, much to his chagrin, he didn't have any roti, and today not even rice. So he was in a particular town and he was just walking despondent like anything and thinking, Krishna, what are you doing? And then he heard a loud voice from a building nearby. And the man was waving out, he says, please come, come into the building, come up. So he said, oh, finally. So he went in and he climbed up. And this man welcomed him. And he was, as he introduced himself, he said, you know, I'm from Mathura. You look like a Vaishnava with this tilak and this cloth, this saffron cloth. I'm from Mathura. Oh, you're from a place of Lord Krishna. He said, yeah, you know, I haven't met a devotee of Krishna for so long. I'm so happy to meet you, he told this brahmachari. The brahmachari sat him down and said, you think you're happy to meet me? I am happy to meet you. Finally, he got some roti and chapati and sabji. But it restored his faith. Of course, he hadn't lost his faith, but, you know, it just helps. So he ate the roti and he was happy again. So that's the culture, that's the principle. You see a sadhu, you see anyone, you call him up and feed him. You know, this is how it is. So this man, he may not have said, is anyone hungry? But he saw a sadhu, he went out and beckoned to him and called him and served him. So that is devotee culture, that is Vedic culture in general. Even today, till this day, there are many Babajis who live in Braja, in Vrindavan and Govardhan, Nandagram and so on, who just go home to home and they beg bhiksha. Mate bhiksham dehi, bhiksham dehi. Oh mother, please give me, because it's the ladies who are at home mostly and the men are out at work. Oh mother, please give me some bhiksha, please give me some alms. And the lady of the house will gladly come and give, you know, something. Even the poorest of Braja Vrindavan, Brajabasi families, the poorest of them, they will give at least one roti. And this is called the principle of Madhu Kari, meaning like a bee. that goes from flower to flower. It takes a little nectar here, a little nectar there, a little nectar there. So the renunciant or the sadhu who is following the principle of Madhukari doesn't go to any one house and take his whole meal because it might inconvenience them because they may be very poor. So he just takes a little something, a little sabji from here, a little sabji from there, a roti from here. And after all, there are many sadhus who come like this. So the poor families, you know, how can they feed everybody? So they take a little something. Shukadev Goswami also, we read in the Srimad Bhagavatam, he would wander from house to house, and every house in those days had a cow, at least. And he would reach there at the time when the cow was being milked, and he would wait patiently, just as long as it took for the cow to be milked, and then he would drink the milk, offer respects, maybe speak a few words of wisdom, and then go back, go away. And the householder was very happy to be of such service to the guests, the sadhus. Similarly, ashrams, temples, even traditionally today, many of the older temples, the traditional temples, the mathas, they will serve food to everyone. It's prasadam. They serve to anyone and everyone who comes. This is the culture. Another injunction is, even if you have the nectar of immortality, that is the amrit of the devas for which they churn the ocean of milk, you know. Even if you have that, you should not consume it till you've shared it with a guest who may be waiting outside. So, I mean, that's something. Normally, if you get something really delicious and you think, oh my God, this I just got this Mahaprasad barfi and this person comes right in front of me, you see, you know, keep it behind you. But the thing to do is to share it. Yes, Prabhu, take a piece. What to speak of, even if you have the nectar of immortality, you should share it. In the first canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, the 13th chapter, I think, 7th verse, in Vidura's episode, Srila Prabhupada says in the purport that Vedic culture means that you should even serve a guest who is an enemy in such a way that the enemy will become fearless. And he speaks, he elaborates on this principle. But because this is such an important point and there are many nuanced ideas we need to consider about this, so we'll talk about this principle of serving an enemy or someone who comes with an inimical intent to us and what do we do with respect to such a guest. We'll talk about this day after tomorrow. So in any case, this is an important principle. In India, there is a saying or a common belief that if a guest leaves your home dissatisfied, he leaves behind his sins and he takes away your pious activities. Yeah, think about it. You better serve the guest properly. I mean, it doesn't mean we should be terrified every time a guest comes. My God, a guest is coming. He's going to leave away, take away my pious activities. Oh my God. No, it's not like that. It's just a very, such a sublime, beautiful culture, you see. You serve everyone. It's so nice. It's such a happy life, a happy society when you're feeding everybody. You can walk into anybody's home and just eat. And even if the food has run out, the hostess will actually cook again and make sure you eat sumptuously. And of course, remember that serving guests like this can be troublesome, but it can also be extremely joyful. And in the Vedic culture, people took great joy in taking trouble to serve a guest. You see, we may think of it today, in today's day and age, where we have the nuclear families, that it is a botheration, you know, to serve a guest. And practically speaking, realistically, it may even be so. I mean, who's going to cook for so many people? I'm so tired. I'm not well. And I've been back, I've had a long day at work. And then who's going to clean up? And who's going to serve everybody and keep them happy, and you have to be smiling. And it's just too much for me, Prabhu. I can't do that. It's very difficult to do it. Indeed, it may be. So we find a practical solution. You don't have to do it every day, but at least that principle of living to serve everybody else. It's so noble, so nice, it's so beautiful, this whole culture. Of course, in the earlier days, you had the joint family system, where the labor, the work, the service was distributed, so it didn't come onto one person. So you could serve guests very nicely, and it was not a botheration. And then it was one big celebration when guests came to the home. The kids would play, the elders would play, they would chat with each other, and there would be, food being served, delicacies being offered. There are always delicacies stored in the house. You know, because when guests come, at least you can offer them these delicacies, some dry items. Even if you didn't have time to cook, you had something dry, some sweets and so on, always kept at home, ready to serve. In fact, Prabhupada says in one place, in one letter, that every temple should have, you know, dao made ready and, you know, vegetables kept, cut and covered with a wet cloth so that any time in the middle of the night somebody comes, you just make the chapatis or puris and then make a sabji and then serve the guest in the middle of the night. He says this at one time. Every temple should do that, he says. So, you know, this is culture. We try the best we can do in our situation. So because of the earlier culture of joint families, these things were possible and people lived like that. It was a very joyous occasion. Now, culture, as far as taking care of guests, wasn't restricted only to human beings. Even this hospitality extended to all creatures, to birds, to animals. I remember growing up as a boy, I always saw my mother putting grains for the birds outside. We had a little basket which was hung outside the window. Although we were living in a multi-story building, but there was some, and we had these sparrows and crows and other birds coming and eating. Today you will find in homes, even today, probably in different parts of the world, where there is a tree within the courtyard, you hang a little basket that has grains and a little water, so that birds come and they drink the water and they eat the grains and go away. You'll find today many people who go to places where there are the birds that congregate, they just throw grains like that. And the birds, the pigeons and other birds just come and eat. You'll see them going to a pond and throwing crumbs into the pond to feed the fish. And even the animals. But of course they wouldn't keep the animals at home, as I was saying, because that is, they're unclean. So it's not good to keep them there. And then when they're at home, you become attached to them. And then you think of them a lot, and then your next birth is risky. So better to keep these animals out, but serve them nicely. So this was how broad in scope the Vedic culture was. And let's talk about a few instances. It's getting close to 10 o'clock. Maybe I'll tell you one little story before we end up and we leave 5 or 10 minutes for questions. I'll start with a story from the Ramayana, which is also one of my favorites for such sessions. This story was narrated by Sita Devi, to Hanuman. After Lord Ram had entered Lanka and he had killed Ravana and destroyed Ravana's army, Hanuman was sent by Ram to the Ashoka Grove where Sita was held captive. And Ram said to Hanuman, go and inform Sita that Ravan has been killed. I am victorious and I have come to take her back with me. So Hanuman immediately went to the Ashoka Grove. He met Sita and he informed her of the good tidings. She was overjoyed. And then Hanuman said, if you like, my dear goddess, I shall destroy all these Rakshasis, all these demonesses who were deputed by Ravana to guard you, because they have tormented you for such a long time. They showed you their hideous faces, they made faces at you, they growled at you, they abused you, they threatened you, even though they didn't physically touch you, but they tortured you mentally and verbally in so many ways. So just give me the green signal and I'll kill them all just now. And she said, no, Hanuman. Just because they wanted to do evil to us, we should not do evil to them. Let me tell you a story. So then she told the story of a hunter who was in a forest. And he suddenly came across a tiger. The tiger was hungry. So the tiger began to chase this hunter. The hunter fled for his life. And he climbed up the nearest tree that he could find to save himself. And finally he did manage to do so. And the tiger, unable to climb the tree, was growling in frustration standing below. Now as he climbed up, he went to as high a branch as he could. Now, as it happened, by the arrangement of Providence, there was also a bear who lived on that tree. Bears, as you know, climb trees very well. So the bear had been asleep, but hearing the commotion, the bear woke up. And the tiger was looking up expectantly at the hunter, and then he noticed the bear was there as well. So he spoke to the bear and said, "My dear friend bear." Now this tiger was extremely shrewd and cunning. So he spoke to the bear and said, "My dear bear, just see, our mutual enemy, man, has come and taken shelter of your home. See, we are friends because we are animals, but this human, he is our enemy. So let's cooperate. You know, you push this human down, and then I'll eat him, and I'll be satisfied, and we can make a pact of friendship. Whenever you're in trouble in the forest, I'll come to your protection, to your rescue." So the bear replied, "My dear tiger, this tree is my home. This man has come seeking my hospitality, seeking shelter in my home. He is a guest for me. So how can I turn him away? How can I be a treacherous person like this? How can I be a traitor? I can't betray his faith. He has come into my house, and therefore I will give him shelter and protection." And he went back to sleep. Now, the tiger was thinking for a while, but shrewd as he was, now he spoke to the human who was still trembling in fear. He spoke to the hunter and said, "Psst, psst, psst, come look here. You know, let's have an agreement. You push this bear down, and I'll eat the bear. I'll satisfy my hunger. And then we'll make a pact, and I will escort you to the edge of the forest. I will protect you personally, so don't fear." So the human, what do you think he did? Pushed the bear. And the bear started falling down. And as he was falling down, he woke up mid-flight. But he managed to grab hold of a big branch. And he saved himself and perched himself on that branch. And the tiger was thinking, "Oh no, second time unlucky." But then he was also very shrewd again. So he told the bear, "Just see how treacherous these humans are. I told you we should collaborate and cooperate. So you still have a chance. See how he betrayed you. You were saying you didn't want to betray him, but he betrayed you. So now push him down." So the bear said, "No, he is still my guest. He is still seeking my shelter. Therefore, I cannot push him down. And just because he has done wrong to me, it doesn't mean that I should do wrong to him." And then Sita Devi explained to Hanuman, these Rakshasis, these demonesses were ultimately just doing the bidding of their master Ravana. It's not their fault, because had they not done his bidding, they would have been killed by Ravana. So the moral of the story in this connection for us is that someone who comes seeking our hospitality, seeking our shelter, is our guest. So we have to serve him. The very least we can do to serve that person is to protect that person. So there are many, many nice pastimes about serving guests and hospitality. We've had many lectures previously, I believe, by different speakers, and you've heard many past times. And over the next two evenings, we'll try to have a discussion of some more pastimes. There won't be as much philosophy, I promise you. There'll be more of pastimes. But today's philosophical background, I felt, was very essential. So it gave us a kind of a perspective and a proper logical understanding of why these things are important in the Vedic culture. So we have just 5 minutes. If there are any comments or questions, please feel to do so.